This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of November, and this week, President Biden signed the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which will add hundreds of billions of dollars of additional spending on roads, bridges, transit, rail, water, and power infrastructure over the next 8 years. That's on top of the regular highway bill spending that also got rolled into this package. And that all produced some good headlines and some infighting even among Republicans about whether the party helped Biden too much in getting this deal over the line, but does not appear so far to have pushed up the president's sagging poll numbers, at least according to the Quinnipiac poll. And the vice president has been spending the week trying to tamp down stories about fighting between her loyalists and Biden's staff about whether she's been given bad policy assignments like immigration that have set her up to fail. To talk about that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute on the right. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Josh.
And on the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Josh.
So, Liz, it's never been super clear to me how progressives really feel about this bill, because the way I feel like this bill has been talked about on the left has been so tied up with how it affects prospects for passage of the other bill with social spending and more climate spending in it that they're hoping to tie up in the next couple of weeks. But what about this package itself, its merits? You know, there's water upgrades to remove lead pipes, power upgrades to support renewables and resiliency, transit, even roads. These are concrete benefits to the public to brag about, right? And I mean, for example, Pramila Jayapal, who's the head of the Progressive Caucus in the House, was giving really forthright bragging about this bill in a way that makes sense. But I feel like I have not been seeing so much in the lead up to its passage.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you've identified the reason why. And so I think really the left's feelings on this bill are split in about three ways. One, for the reason you mentioned, it's tied up with this Build Back Better problem that involves social spending and the left's sort of dwindling hope that we're going to see a really significant progressive move in that bill. And so I think the left has been focusing most or even all of its energy in that direction as opposed to in the direction of the infrastructure bill. That being said, I think, you know, simply on the merits and separate from whatever happens with Build Back Better, the infrastructure bill, as you rightly point out, has quite a bit to recommend it. We look back on the years we have spent campaigning for, water safety in places like Flint, and this is obviously a huge improvement, and will make a big difference, especially to very poor communities, if we can get the resources out there and make these projects happen, which I hope we can. And so, right, on the merits, a very good thing. And then I think, you know, the third issue is, I think the left is skeptical of some of the electoral claims that centrist, or, you know, mainstream Democrats have attached to the infrastructure bill, that this will be a sort of signal achievement that will perhaps, catapult Democrats to electoral victories in the midterms or even in 2024. That's something that you occasionally hear now that the infrastructure bill has passed, that this was something that Trump was unable to do, that Biden was able to do, and therefore Biden might be able to make some hay out of it, as to where a lot of forecasts have Democrats facing really terrible odds in these upcoming elections. I think the left is very skeptical of that because these infrastructure projects often take a really long time to complete or get rolling, especially when we're dealing with shipping issues and supply chain problems. It could be especially difficult to get these projects completed. And so with these elections pretty imminent, I think they might not have the electoral impact that Democrats are hoping for. That's a problem. And the left is concerned about that. And I think, as usual, emphasizing, hey, you know, we may not actually be able to get these bridges built, these pipes replaced, et cetera, within the next few months, couple of years, but we could actually get money into bank accounts with social spending as soon as we want, essentially. And so, that's one of the left arguments against focusing on simply infrastructure for electoral reasons and for focusing more on social spending.
Tim, it's interesting the flip side of that, because I think a lot of the reason that you have this infighting in the Republican Party over the fact that 13 Republicans in the House voted for this bill, of course, 19 Republicans in the Senate voted for it. It was a truly, it wasn't a bipartisan coalition in the Senate in the sense of picking off a few people. It was really a wide swath of the Republican Party that joined there. In the House, those 13 votes were the reason that Nancy Pelosi did not need to herd together her entire caucus. She was able to lose 6 votes and still pass this, even though she does not even have a 6-vote majority in the House. So there's that political concern that the Democrats were allowed this win. And then there's also substantive policy objections from many Republicans to this bill. They basically think it's too large and spends money on the wrong things. But it's been interesting to me to see, you know, we've had so much of infighting among Democrats over the last few months. This is the first, aside from fighting over who was loyal enough to Donald Trump, this is the first that I've seen this year where you really see Republicans fixate on whether they have the wrong strategy.
Well, and I do think that the fighting is more over whether you want to legislate or just politic, and that in both parties, in both chambers, the number one rule has been don't give the other side a victory. You remember the Democrats even did this on some of the criminal justice reform. Why would you want to normalize Trump by passing a good bill and letting him get the signing ceremony? And so it's unfortunate for me that that's a debate, because I think there are lots of good debates. I mean, where the heck do we get $1.2 trillion from? Yes, lots of this money is absolutely needed, but we don't do anything to sort of reform the supply chain problems in this. And the cost and the slowness that Liz is talking about on these building things, a lot of those have to do with federal regulations regarding labor, regarding the environment, et cetera. And so you could have, you know, these bypasses around Atlanta get built quicker if there was willing to be some reform. So that's where, if more Republicans were interested in legislating, they could have said, actually, we'll support this as long as we get, some reform on federal contracting, highway contracting, that sort of thing. But really, I think the divide is that there are some of these old school guys, tellingly, you had Don Young of Alaska, who just loves building stuff. And then you had a lot of guys who think, well, maybe we ought to legislate. But in both parties, the main goal is to get elected and get your party into the majority. To do what with that, I don't know, because when they get the majority, most of them are not that interested in legislating.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, that's interesting about the cost problems here, because we've spent a lot of time on this show talking about what's wrong with the structure of certain programs in the social spending package that's being worked on, in ways that it's going to spend money inefficiently, that it's maybe not going to produce the results that Democrats are hoping for and promising. But you have a lot of those same issues with this infrastructure, especially infrastructure related to transportation. I mean, I look at this, I'm pretty gung-ho about the power and water stuff in here, and I think that we generally, when rules allow us to build long-distance transmission lines that we need, and there are sort of boring technical fixes that need to be done on that, but when we can build that stuff, I think we get good value for money on it. I think we really very often don't with a lot of the transportation infrastructure, both roads and rail. We pay multiples of what gets paid in Europe and Asia to build these sorts of things. And it feels to me like neither the left nor the center nor the right has been really eager to take that issue up in the United States. I sit in New York City, where for decades now we've been fighting over, we're going to build another tunnel for trains under the Hudson River. And you get terrible warnings about, oh no, the existing tunnel is going to be shut down for 9 months and it's going to cause all these economic problems. And none of the fixes involve figuring out how come we can't build this for like $4 billion instead of $20 billion in the way that they would in France. And it again feels like, you know, there's a willingness to throw money at problems, but then it takes forever. You get a small fraction of what you should have gotten in terms of output. And then that leaves people looking, I think, accurately at this and saying, you know, the government can't deliver for me what I was looking for in this area.
No, and I think that's a completely reasonable way to feel about it. And I think there are a lot of reasons why that is the case. Some of it is redundant and ineffective bureaucracy. A lot of it is inefficiency. A lot of it is just really unwise and, frankly, ridiculous perspectives on how to go about things like urban planning. Some of it, not all of it, has to do with the way that the United States is set up as a country with these sort of different state governments, especially when we're doing interstate transportation and commerce. And so you have sort of different jurisdictions that have to cooperate and aren't necessarily very good at it. But, there are several reasons that we're bad at this in a way that other countries just aren't. And I think that's really evident when you're in Europe or Asia, and getting around is just efficient in a way that it's not in the United States. And this is another major failure of American governance. And I mean, I wish I understood it. It's obviously feasible and doable. And when it comes to asking the American people to have trust in the American government to deliver on certain things, you know, I don't have difficulty understanding why they might not. I just focus, therefore, very much on trying to convince our legislators to create programs, endorse programs that work efficiently, that work well, that work in other countries.
So, to that point, I mean, there will be outputs from this package sooner or later, and we're already seeing even members of Congress who didn't vote for it going back to their districts and touting the things that are going to be built and bridges that will be replaced. And it's not all supposed to be delivered in the next year, but at least maybe signs will go up and say, you know, here a new bridge is going in here. Tim, I know that Democrats hope and Republicans fear that this is going to do something significant to turn around the president's political fortunes, to show here Democrats are working, they're delivering something concrete. Does that concern you? Do you see this as a turning point at all politically?
No, I mean, what would help Joe Biden is if we could get stuff on time and prices come down. And there's no reason to think that this bill, even if it could lay down the pavement tomorrow, would have any effect on that. And as Liz said, none of this money is going directly to people, and we don't need a stimulus right now. So I don't see a political upside here, because again, what we're seeing is inflation and the inability to get stuff that we need. That's the economic problem. This doesn't fix that.
And so, Liz, I think it's fair to say that's not just true of this bill. It's also going to be true of the Build Back Better bill. So suppose that passes in the next 4 weeks. They get their act together. They reach an agreement. There's another big signing ceremony. What do Democrats do next?
I mean, I think that's a good question. In terms of the shipping problem and getting goods to the United States, you know, there are elements of that that are just beyond the control of Biden and his administration. That sucks. It sucks when you are in power and there's a global supply chain issue, or demand just shoots up really high and the global supply chain has difficulty coping with it. You know, there are ways to kind of package that that make it less traumatic to deal with. But, you know, that's just something that Biden and the Democrats are going to have to deal with. And maybe part of it is just in the Cuomo fashion, getting on TV, talking about how it sucks and saying, I'm trying to do something about it. That would be, you know, better than doing nothing. Inflation is something that people are obviously becoming increasingly concerned about. Taking them seriously on that front and not trying to just avoid responsibility for it or blame it on situations that are, you know, beyond his control, et cetera, et cetera. Again, it seems like better than nothing, although I'm not sure that will save Biden from, you know, electoral punishment for that issue either. In terms of policy to focus on, you know, I have a certain sympathy with social spending. And so, you know, even if they get Build Back Better through, there are so many things in that bill itself that just suck. And there are so many things that should be there and aren't. And there are so many things that are happening that shouldn't. I mean, I would just recommend that the Democrats seriously reevaluate their priorities and reevaluate their messaging. You know, for instance, it looks like they're going to have some really measly, sort of pathetic paid leave provision in the Build Back Better bill, something like 4 weeks that excludes a large percentage of new parents. And simultaneously, it appears that they're going to start requiring women to register for the draft. And so we're going to become a country where women need to register to potentially fight and die in foreign wars. I realize that's unlikely to happen. We haven't had the draft in a very long time. But even symbolically, women register for the draft, but you can't get time off to take care of your newborns. that's just no kind of equality. It's like an aggressively anti-feminist kind of equality. This is something that sucks for men, so we're going to make it suck for women too, without actually providing any kind of leeway for areas of life where women, qua women, actually do need time and accommodation. And so, I mean, Democrats are just really, really whiffing hugely on the things that they say are their own priorities. And it's really hard for me to understand how that isn't just a disaster for them. So that's what I would recommend that they try to clean up, is they take those issues head on. And then from there, try to focus on a more coherent and popular coronavirus response.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner and AEI and Elizabeth Bruning of The Atlantic to talk about those coronavirus responses. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our Left, Right, and Center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Bruning, staff writer at The Atlantic. Public health officials in several states, including California, have announced that COVID vaccine boosters are available to all adults who were vaccinated at least 6 months ago. But the federal guidelines remain convoluted. There is a matrix of criteria, and if you look really closely at the matrix, you can see that nearly any adult who was vaccinated at least 6 months ago does qualify. For example, you're federally eligible for a booster if you have a body mass index of at least 25, which 3/4 of American adults do. If you're 5'10", that means you have to weigh at least 174 pounds. It's not really that high a weight. You also qualify if you were ever a smoker, or if you've been diagnosed with depression, or if you work in certain very common fields like education. But having all of those rules that add up to almost everyone should get a booster has stepped up on the message. Many people don't know the government thinks they should get a booster. They don't know what all those rules are. They don't know they apply to almost everyone. And so this is why you see a number of states stepping out ahead of the federal government, and you see pressure on the Biden administration to announce a simpler, more comprehensive rule. And yet that's tied up in a bureaucratic process where there have to be meetings at the FDA and the CDC and all of these recommendations, and the CDC director needs to make a final sign-off and blah, blah, blah. Tim, this is driving me absolutely bonkers, because no one is substantively defending this policy, as far as I can tell, or almost nobody is. So why doesn't the president just step in and say, we're going to do what California is doing, what New York City is doing, announce a simple rule and tell people, you know, you should come get your booster?
I have to suspect that the president is in the pocket of big Twinkies and soda and beer and trying to get everybody's body mass index up above 25%. No, I did not realize I qualified for the fat booster until you just told me that. So thank you, John.
Yeah, see? You didn't know.
No, and in my state, at least in my county, Montgomery County, Maryland, which I criticize a lot, they are doing it right, where you show up and they don't ask you any questions. They simply... they give you the booster. I think they might ask you if your vaccination was more than 6 months ago. But after that, my wife, who does not qualify for the fat booster by any stretch, she showed up and she got the booster with no questions asked. And that is, they sort of kind of admit that they're looking the other way because the rules are stupid. And so this is a story of the coronavirus pandemic writ large, which is really that you have rules that people don't really believe in, but they're the rules. And so we follow them. So you really, this is a great opportunity for federal leadership, for Joe Biden just to say, hey, look, anybody who wants it, who's, you know, maybe set the 6 month threshold and say, go and get it. And then you can have lots of states with different guidelines on certain things. And your doctor can tell you, well, I mean, for instance, I got coronavirus last month, so I don't have any intention to get the booster, but maybe before I travel internationally, I will. Federal leadership should just say, open it up, let people make this decision for themselves, especially in consultation with their doctors.
Liz, I think there is a crazy elitism to this practice where you basically have whisper rules, and you know it's an open secret that the guidelines are bad and that people should go get it because the secret is not actually open to everyone. And you saw this even more a couple of months ago before the federal rules opened up to the extent that they had, where you had people going and just quietly getting additional boosters before the CDC had recommended them to most anyone. And you saw journalists talking about how their doctors, even health officials, were recommending to them quietly to go do this. It seems like if something is known among elites to be a desirable practice, to be one that will make you safer, the government should go out and loudly tell everybody to do it. And it really undermines trust when you have a different official rule from what sort of unofficially is quote unquote known to be the rule.
Well, right. I mean, especially if you're going to be obnoxious about it, which is another aspect of the whisper network concerning booster shots and other COVID practices, which is it's understood among a certain educated class of people that you're supposed to do these things, and also that doctors will do it even if you're a little bit outside certain guidelines or time limits or whatnot. And also, if other people don't, that, they're rubes and, causing problems and harm and so forth. I think absolutely the federal government should put out extremely clear, very simple guidelines that should be made available everywhere, in every municipal bus, in every subway car, all over the place, post offices, banks. They should be unavoidable. I don't understand why that's a problem. It shouldn't be this complicated. As you say, for a large number of people, it's not. You just go get the shot, right? And then you walk out and that's it. And if it's that simple for some people, it should be that simple for all people, and that should be clear.
I think the thing that's lurking in the background here is concern as we enter the winter, the extent to which there might be another COVID wave that focuses on the North in the way that much of the American South got hit hard this summer when the weather was unbearably warm down there. I think it's an open question. I think people have been sort of talking fatalistically about there's going to be a winter wave, which, I'm sure there will be some uptick in cases, but not necessarily anywhere close to what we were looking at last year. But you have a number of these things that you can do now that will mitigate that effect, that will save lives, and will also reduce the amount of disruption that we will have as we go into the winter. So one of those obvious things is people going out and getting boosters. You now have vaccines approved for children as young as 5. And so to the extent that there's uptake for that, and we've seen about 10% of those eligible children in that age group get their first shot within the first 10 days. And then you're seeing fights over mask mandates and whether they should be taken off or come back in. Washington, D.C. is getting rid of it at the same time as Tim's home county in the suburbs is apparently about to put it back in. You had the health director in Los Angeles County saying that it's likely to have a mask mandate into next year because it's cooling off in L.A. And then you also have this very promising antiviral pill from Pfizer that isn't yet approved. And even when it is approved, you're going to have to ramp up production. We can't have it in the hands of every person who gets infected with COVID in the next 3 months. But hopefully that will become a standard thing by sometime next year for COVID infections. That pill apparently reduces by 90% the risk of severe illness and death. But basically, it's a matter of how quickly can we get as many of these effective things done in a way that saves lives and also reduces the amount of disruption that we experienced this winter. And Tim, I don't feel like that's being thought about in a very rigorous manner in a lot of these jurisdictions.
No, and you could almost form a meta debate if you look at D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who said that she believes that just looking at case counts is not proper and we should look at other things, including vaccination rates, as well as more serious effects rather than just a positive test, which, again, I, as a vaccinated guy, when I got it coronavirus last month, it was 2 days of taking Advil. That isn't a big deal. What's a big deal is an 80-year-old or an unvaccinated person or somebody who's going to have a seriously bad outcome getting hospitalized or dying. Those ought to be the measures, in part because these pills, Pfizer's pill, some of the studies suggest it's 90% reduction in hospitalization. That would totally neuter this virus. But then also masking, we know it's not super effective. So some say, well, we're going to throw everything at it. We're going to do everything we can to stop this winter surge. There's got to be cost-benefit analysis. Detroit is closing schools on Fridays now, sort of to fight off this winter wave. Has anybody done any cost-benefit analysis on this? I don't think so. I would want to see that Pfizer pill rushed to market and massive production as much as possible. If I were in charge, that's the number one thing I would do, because what we want to do is not primarily keep people from getting the virus. It's keep people from getting seriously ill or dying. Vaccines, and it looks like this Pfizer medication, are what do that.
Well, and we want to keep schools operating as normally as possible. And Liz, Tim mentions Detroit schools going to 4 days a week in person, also happening in Southfield, which is a sizable suburb of Detroit. And this is framed as a COVID response, but my understanding is a lot of this really is about staffing issues, that schools are short on staff for a number of reasons, some of which have to do with the broader issues that are happening with the tight labor market. And some of that is that, you know, you have both students and staff who are routinely affected by they. Either they are actually sick with coronavirus or they're subject to a quarantine or that sort of thing. And so you do see these schools can be disrupted by the rules around them, but schools can also be disrupted by the actual COVID situation on the ground. And I think that pushes in two different directions, because you need to look at those restrictions and say, are these more restrictive than necessary, causing more disruption than necessary? But you also need to look at, you know, to the greater extent that we have a COVID surge in this area, the more that you are going to have necessary disruptions in schools. I think it's a hard question.
It is. And I think, you know, you still, I think, wind up coming to much the same conclusion as Tim. We need to just get every possible treatment out there as soon as possible. If we're dealing with schools having to close down routinely because people are getting sick or people get a little bit sick and then they're on these long quarantines, then let's get the pills on the market. Let's get them distributed to people. Let's get them in mass production and circulation. This is how I felt about the vaccines from the beginning. As long as people aren't dying instantly when they're getting vaccinated, just get the shots into people. The worst thing, if they're not killing people, is that they may not work very well. But even if they work a little, that's better than nothing. And you know, that's why even though I had already had COVID by the time the vaccines came out, I went ahead and got vaccinated. I hugely support the approach of let's just get every medical treatment out there and then start looking at cost-benefit analysis. Every time schools shut down, the labor market situation gets worse because, you know, people have to quit. People cannot work if their kids are home. They have to do childcare in that case. And that causes more disruptions in terms of people getting to work and doing their jobs and people who are running businesses being able to find workers and so on and so forth. And that's not good, right? I mean, we need the economy to work. We need production. And so unless we want to switch to sort of full-on socialism where we have, distribution and production sort of nailed down in a sort of permanent fashion and certain number of people doing full-time childcare and so on and so forth, then we need to figure out how to keep the public schools open in a sort of regular and predictable fashion while we transition to a world in which COVID is endemic.
Tim, do you have a sense of what the politics are of this Pfizer oral treatment? And for anyone who hasn't been following it, the Pfizer drug that is so promising, it's an oral treatment. It's basically a series of pills that you take ideally as soon as possible after you contract COVID. But it was effective in people treated as late as 5 days after the onset of their symptoms. I feel like it's a weird question to ask, what are the politics of this? But that's clearly been really important throughout this whole process. People's political orientation has driven which interventions to COVID they are attracted to. And you've seen a number of these sort of meme-y pharmaceutical treatments that don't really have great evidence about their effectiveness, including hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Is this something, if you have, you know, the substantial number of Americans who do not want to get a vaccine, who have resisted getting a vaccine, is this going to be saleable to them in the way that ivermectin was? Because if it is, that's quite a good public health outcome. I don't want people declining a vaccine because of the availability of these pills. But if people are going to be declining the vaccine, I certainly want them taking these pills.
And that's sort of something I'm actively working on with my friends who definitely do not want to get the vaccine, is to say, okay, well, this is something that can reduce hospitalization. Because my biggest argument, in fact, for the vaccine to a lot of my friends who are mothers and fathers is to say, the vaccine reduces your chance of getting this seriously. And so one of my friends said, and you're not going to like this, Josh, but said, well, doesn't the Pfizer drug partly moot that argument for the vaccine? And of course, there are other arguments for the vaccine, including reducing the spread and thus protecting your neighbors and family. But the truth is that it's too early to tell whether this will end up in the pile of things that vaccine skeptical people are willing to take. The fact that it had Pfizer's name attached to it might be a negative, but the fact that it's not the vaccine and it's not being mandated on anyone makes me hopeful that people who of all stripes, vaccinated and unvaccinated, will take this drug, because again, this could massively reduce hospitalization. And if this virus is spreading but not sending people to the hospital and not killing people, then we get to roll back hopefully all of these mitigation efforts.
Yeah, I mean, Liz, one of the things that I've found frustrating through this process is the sort of the armchair psychology that you get from a lot of public health officials about, like, oh, well, if we say X, then it might discourage people from taking other intervention. Why? It's one of the arguments that has slowed down the broad booster guidance, that somehow if you tell everyone to get a booster, that's going to discourage certain people from being vaccinated for reasons I don't fully understand. I guess the idea is that it emphasizes that maybe the vaccine isn't as good as people thought it was a few months ago. But a lot of that is basically guessing. And I lean toward your approach of, you know, just throw everything at it that we can. Because even if some people are going to be waved off of A because of B, then that seems like extra reason to have both A and B out there so that people will take what is available to them. And that's been the thing that has been pushing down the fatality rate from this over time, that you have a number of different interventions, some of them social and some of them vaccines and some of them treatments. And even if people don't use all of them, the more options that are out there and the more people that you get to take up as many of them as possible, that's what turns this into a normal disease over time.
Right. I mean, I think you have multiple problems at play in the public sphere with respect to how medicine is thought about. I think on the one hand, you have public health officials, especially doctors, who tend to project an inappropriate level of confidence in their capacities and expertise. And even when they don't do that, you have a sort of media class that projects an inappropriate level of confidence in the capacities and knowledge of medical professionals. And then, you know, frequently things change, right? Studies come out, longitudinal studies come out, new treatments are discovered, diseases mutate, etc. The facts on the ground change. And so then these proclamations that came out of medical officials several months or a year ago are no longer relevant. This causes people who were, you know, incredibly admonished and scolded, you know, via the advice of medical professionals very recently to feel like, oh, ho, ho, now who's, you know, ridiculous, now who can't be trusted, now who's an idiot, et cetera, et cetera. And then that creates, you know, this kind of fodder for this ongoing legitimation crisis. My approach to it is just to be a little more lukewarm on the whole thing. So I have epilepsy. I have been sick my whole life. You know, doctors are doing the best they can. They're not miracle workers. They're just people. They have a lot more information about the body than I do. And typically, they're very good at what they do. But you have to understand that they're just improving your odds. That's all they can do. They're not miracle workers. They can't just destroy every disease or guarantee that the treatments they give you are going to be 100% efficacious 100% of the time. They never can do that. And besides, everybody dies. They can't cure death. And so, of course, there are going to be problems anytime a doctor is treating 100 people with one condition, right? Not every single person treated for the same condition is going to have a good outcome. That's just the odds. But they can improve everybody's odds. versus having no treatment. That's how you've got to look at it, in my view. And so what that requires is, I think, the media projecting a whole lot less a sort of, you know, brutal scolding and assertiveness about what these medical professionals are saying. Just sort of get the advice out there without the listen up, morons, et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, that way when the advice changes or the outcomes are not 100% as would be fitting for this intense level of confidence, then there is not so much impulse to say, see, I told you so, who's laughing now? I mean, I understand it's frustrating to have to play these ridiculous rhetorical games in the midst of a pandemic, but that's where we are. So in terms of the COVID pill, I'm COVID pilled. I hope everybody gets COVID pilled. I hope it works. I hope it helps. It's not going to be a miracle, but nothing is.
One thing that I hope that we learn from this whole process is that, you know, I think we've often failed to identify what experts are expert in and what you're supposed to listen to them about and what you're supposed to apply your own judgment about. I mean, the question of what the vaccine will do if you administer it to people versus if you don't, that's a question for medical experts. And that's something that public officials should be intently listening to the experts about. The question of who should get the vaccine is a public policy question that is fundamentally a question for lay people. You take that expert information about what the vaccine does and you apply it to questions of values and you apply it to questions of cost-benefit analysis that include matters that are not within the realm of the medical experts, and you make that decision. That's something that Joe Biden, frankly, should have been doing personally earlier on the boosters, that you had the expert information about what boosters were going to do. That information was changing over time and improving, but that information was clear enough that there should have been a political decision that said, it's time to recommend this to everyone. You're seeing governors making that political decision, because that isn't a question for the experts. That's a question for the people that we elect to lead us. And so I think, you know, I think the Biden administration will be getting around to that belatedly, but I think you're seeing we lost a period of a couple of months in a way that is going to lead to more death and more disruption this winter than we should have had. I want to leave it there on this segment. I've been talking with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner and AEI and Elizabeth Brunig of the Atlantic. We'll be back with Uli Wein to talk about the summit between President Biden and Xi Jinping. This is Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Tim Carney, senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. President Biden had a summit of sorts with Chinese leader Xi Jinping on Monday, if you can call a Zoom meeting a summit. The meeting came at a time of high tension between the U.S. and China over human rights, trade, and relations with Taiwan. There are also areas where the two countries are making a show of working together, like climate. The Biden administration sought to present the meeting as a constructive dialogue on behalf of two countries with different goals and values. And China echoed this message, talking of the two countries as two great ships that must be steered to avoid a collision. But Xi Jinping also issued a warning. We are patient and willing to strive for the prospect of peaceful reunification with the utmost sincerity, he told the president about Taiwan, according to a readout. But China will have to take resolute measures if the Taiwan independent separatist forces provoke, compel, or even cross the red line, unquote. So where does this leave the U.S.-China relationship and the prospect for military escalation or war in the region? Uli Wein is a senior analyst with Eurasia Group's Global Macro Practice. He studies U.S.-China relations. He's also affiliated with the Atlantic Council and the Modern War Institute, and he joins us now. Hi, Uli.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Great. It's great to have you back. So what did this summit do?
There were many readouts of the summit that were kind of lukewarm, that said that the outcomes of the summit were modest, the summit didn't really accomplish all that much. And I think that we have to, when we evaluate any kind of high-level dialogue between great powers, I think that we have to calibrate our criteria for evaluation against the backdrop of the underlying relationship. So the backdrop is a great power relationship in free fall, at least up until recently, I think a great power relationship that had been in free fall and remains systemically strained. And so given that backdrop, even, quote unquote, even an agreement to try and make a good faith effort to arrest that deterioration, or at least arrest a further deterioration of the relationship, and an agreement to continue high-level dialogue strikes me as being not a trivial accomplishment. And I would also make the point that I don't think that either side, either the United States or China, came into the dialogue with the expectation or intention of achieving a significant breakthrough. I think that the objective was these are the two foremost powers in the international system. They will have to cohabitate over the long term. And if you recognize, if there's a mutual recognition that you're going to have to cohabitate over the long term, it's better to talk and to continue talking. And I would say that the risks of silence, just given the stakes of this relationship, the risks of silence, to my mind, outweigh those of dialogue, even if the dialogue doesn't produce the kind of breakthroughs for which one might hope.
I think I'm like a lot of Americans when I watch the situation over Taiwan. And first of all, there's like this odd fiction underlying it that Taiwan is not an independent country. And I understand the deep history of that and the reasons and the usefulness of that fiction. But I look at this and it's this situation that has been precarious, but in one way or another, fairly stable for decades. How much risk is there there? When this rhetoric escalates, what is the prospect of a war over Taiwan that could draw the U.S. into it?
So I would argue that the near-term risk of a military confrontation over Taiwan remains low for a few reasons. Number one, despite the rhetoric that we're hearing coming out of Chinese President Xi Jinping and top Chinese advisors, the rhetoric isn't new. Every leader of the People's Republic of China has stressed that China's national rejuvenation is predicated upon reunification with the mainland. And so in that regard, we're not seeing a rhetorical departure by Xi Jinping, number one. Number two, if China were to launch an incursion against Taiwan, the potential ramifications for China are difficult to overstate. There would be the prospect of devastating military retaliation, and not only by the United States, but also potentially involving Japan and Australia. Also, Taiwan is home to the world's most important semiconductor manufacturing company, namely TSMC. And China depends inordinately on chips from TSMC to fuel its own technological development. So any armed confrontation would put TSMC and TSMC's output in jeopardy. And then there would be the risk of crushing economic sanctions and even further diplomatic opprobrium. It would be virtually impossible in the aftermath of any kind of incursion for China to maintain even a semblance of stable relations with advanced industrial democracies, which still wield the preponderance of global power. So I should just make one last point, then I'll stop, which is that I think that China right now is engaged in this heightened nationalism in part because it has the 20th Party Congress coming up next fall. So I would expect that between now and next fall, when Xi Jinping is looking to secure a norm-defying third term at the helm of China, I would expect to see more saber-rattling vis-a-vis Taiwan. I would expect to see more intimidating behaviors vis-a-vis Taiwan. But I still think it's hard to think of one single step that would do more to derail the prospects for China's further resurgence than launching an incursion against Taiwan.
So I guess I have to ask very directly, what is the U.S. interest in combating some of China's sort of more imperial designs right now? When we worry about the economic development, the Belt and Road type initiative, and so on, sort of economic front, and then hints at sort of, you know, military movements, these are not cost-free sort of counters that's being proposed vis-a-vis China's expansionism. Explain to Americans why we need to worry about China's apparent expansionism.
So I think that there are a number of factors at play. And I think that, you know, one of the core factors is that, you know, the United States, for the better part of the past, you could say three quarters of a century at this point, approaching 80 years, you know, the United States has helped to construct and undergirded this, you know, what we now call this post-war order. And it's a post-war order that is anchored in certain laws, certain institutions, certain norms. And even though that order is under significant duress from within and without, I think that it continues to furnish a critical source of influence for the United States. I think that there are concerns among U.S. policymakers. If that order were to weaken over time. And if China were to establish an order more consonant with its own preferences, there are concerns about what types of laws, institutions, and values might undergird that system. And there are concerns, would that order be more hierarchical? Would it be more authoritarian? Would it be more coercive? So I think that one concern is maintaining some semblance of an order that's more consonant with democratic values than with authoritarian values. There's one last factor I would say is at work, and I don't want to sound almost philosophical, but I think it's important to bring up an almost psychological dimension. 30 years ago, rewinding the clock to the end of the Cold War, there was a lot of triumphalism in the United States, and there was at least a hope that with the implosion of the Soviet Union, that the United States had finally vanquished the various isms that had afflicted it, or that had beset it, or confronted it for several decades. So fascism, authoritarianism, totalitarianism, communism. There was a feeling that the United States had once and for all consigned these various isms to the ash heap of history, and that the United States could enter into a different phase of geopolitics. And I think that the United States felt at that time that China was also on the wrong side of history. And I think that if you are the world's only superpower, of course you're going to experience anxiety if you enter into a period of relative decline. But I think that anxiety is even more acute when your principal strategic competitor is a country that you had thought to have been on the wrong side of history just 30 years ago, and that ideologically is so different from you.
Liz, I know that you and like a lot of people on the left, I think, have been fairly skeptical and critical of a lot of the things that the U.S. does in order to maintain that global leadership role and the various military and economic interventions that the U.S. undertakes around the world in order to maintain that position, that influence. Does this motivate you, the need to be a counterbalance to China, to compete with them, the need to do those things in order to do that? Does that make you more inclined toward that global U.S. role?
No.
So you don't worry about China essentially stepping into our shoes to the extent that we don't do that?
No. I mean, what have we done in our shoes? Nothing good.
That's not true at all.
I don't think that's
true. If we just pulled out of Afghanistan after 20 years to total chaos and failure, we still interested in more adventurism abroad. As recently as Trump's presidency, there were U.S. officials trying to pick a fight with Iran. I'm surprised they didn't succeed. I think it's really only thanks to Trump himself and his own aversion to getting involved in foreign conflicts that go on forever and destroy approval ratings, because he thought of his presidency like a TV show, that we narrowly avoided getting into it with Iran, which would have been a disaster. And I have no faith that in coming administrations, we won't wind up mired in some other horrible, ongoing, incessant drone conflict. The United States being a global superpower has been a disaster for millions and millions of people abroad.
I think the alternative that you can look at is the one that the Biden administration is engaged in right now, where, I mean, you know, you say that Trump was an outlier for being so concerned about ratings, and that pushed him in a good direction on these issues. I mean, Biden, as you wished, withdrew from Afghanistan over the objection of various aspects of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, something that Trump was not able to do. And I think you see in this interaction with China an effort to turn the temperature down a few degrees while continuing to assert U.S. prerogatives about human rights and about the economy and various things in a way that tries to exert that influence without that sort of military interventionism. And I don't know that it's going to work. But I think, you know, it's not a choice between withdrawing from the world and, you know, fighting more Vietnam wars.
I'm not saying that we should withdraw from the world as though we should, you know, nuke our own country. It's just, what, we're saying that the United States' dominance on the global stage has ensured a sort of Pax Americana of glorious human rights? Come on, we had Abu Ghraib. We've all seen the pictures. We have Gitmo. I was at an execution in Mississippi last night. I watched the United States kill a man right in front of me. No less than 6 feet in front of me last night. Human rights? Are you kidding me? Come on.
The alternative, and this is sort of why we're talking about China here, the alternative is not nobody's in charge, right? There's the in a world, in the modern world, there's going to be somebody who's in charge. And Liz, I was, you know, I was against the Iraq war professionally when it was costly to a conservative to be against the Iraq war. All the overreaches that are part of us being the sort of hegemon or near hegemon are lamentable, and they are tied up with that role. But this is sort of why my question again is like, do we need to make sure, we had to make sure that the Soviet Union wasn't going to be the one calling the shots in the planet. That was good that we defeated the Soviet Union. We did it by having a big military. We did a lot of missteps along the way. China, do they really have similar designs? You referred earlier to saber rattling. I mean, is it just saber rattling, or do they really see themselves as expanding in an empire in the way that the Soviet Union did? Because if that's what they're seeing, then we do have to counter that.
Ollie, I don't know. What do you make of that comparison to the Soviet Union from Tim there?
China's economy is far more deeply integrated into the global economy than the Soviet Union's economy ever was. I like a metaphor that Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman have come up with. They liken China's economy and the global economy to Siamese twins that share sort of a circulatory system, that share vital organs, and basically, you know, conjuring up this image of very, very significant interdependence. So I think one difference between present circumstances and those that prevailed during the Cold War is the degree of interdependence between the United States and China, number one. Number two, I think that middle powers, even U.S. allies and partners, I think that they are wary of being trapped in a so-called great power competition between the United States and China. They want greater freedom of maneuver, and they recognize that going forward, they're going to have to deal with both countries. They can't make a strategic choice, as it were, between one or the other. They're going to have to deal with both countries. And I think, you know, going forward, you know, and there are many other differences one could enumerate, but I think that an important one is, the Cold War ended decisively. The Cold War ended with the dissolution of one of the competitors. China, for all of its myriad competitive liabilities at home and abroad, I don't think that it's primed for a dramatic Soviet-style disintegration. I think it's useful to posit a thought experiment. So let's posit a maximalist case. Let's assume, for argument's sake, that China seeks to overtake the United States with global preeminence. It seeks to dissolve the current international system and establish one of its own. Could China actually accomplish those objectives? I think that China's path, not only to global preeminence, but I would say even China's path to regional preeminence, is quite fraught. If you look at, so internally, China's demographic outlook is quite bleak. Environmental degradation is accelerating. China's growth model is coming up against a number of headwinds. And then just in China's immediate periphery, and China's relationships with most major powers, with the exception of Russia, are deteriorating. So when I put together those data points, I don't see a country that's primed for collapse, but I also don't see a country that's destined for global preeminence.
Ollie Wine is a senior analyst with Eurasia Group's Global Macro Practice. Ollie, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Elizabeth Brunig, it's your soapbox.
Today, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt accepted the recommendation of Oklahoma's Pardon and Parole Board and commuted the sentence of Julius Jones, a man who killed an individual named Paul Howell in the course of a carjacking in 1999 when Jones was 19 years old. The sentence, which was death, has now been commuted to life without parole. Supporters of Jones were ecstatic and celebrated at the Capitol, and detractors, who were less detractors of Jones and more detractors of Jones' supporters, are now furious about the decision. I'm not a fan of polarization. I've been pissed off about it for a while. I think it poisons everything, destroys people's judgment, and I've been pretty vocal about it on this show. But it distresses me especially to see it infecting not only the death penalty — I think polarization has affected the death penalty issue for a long time — but the matter of clemency. Mercy has been a Christian virtue for hundreds of years, as long as the religion has been around. And it's really horrifying to me both as a member of the left and as a Christian, to see polarization tearing that apart too.
Tim Carney, what's your rant?
Please stop trying to convince us that what we see before us, what we live through, isn't happening or is just some illusion scared up by a conspiracy involving Fox News. This is what happened in the fall when the major media tried again and again to explain that school parents, especially in Northern Virginia, weren't really upset at what their kids' schools were doing and not doing in places where teachers refused to enter the classroom for a whole year, where healthy kids were being quarantined by the hundreds, and where schools were ignoring learning loss in favor of ideological pursuits about race and transgender politics. Well, parents got angry, and yet major newspapers and cable outlets brushed it aside as some operation by the Manhattan Institute. And so now, please don't repeat that mistake on inflation. Already, liberal journalists are saying inflation that harms regular families is just a myth. Liberal commentator Dave Roberts wrote this past week, quote, "Voters are not primarily responding to inflation. They're responding to a massive, highly coordinated propaganda campaign across multiple media designed to freak them out about inflation." This is a conspiracy theory, and it ignores the facts. Federal data puts inflation at its highest rate in 31 years, and guess what? It's even higher in middle America. Life is becoming more expensive. The latest consumer price index shows an 11.9% increase in the price of meat, poultry, fish, and eggs. I personally tried to price out a used car this week and just gave up. Americans know that what we are seeing at the grocery store, especially those of us who buy multiple cartons of eggs and even gallons of milk per week, and we can debate the causes and proper responses to this inflation, but please stop trying to tell us that it's not happening.
Instead of a rant, I have an announcement this week. At the end of the year, I will be stepping down as the host of Left, Right, and Center and leaving KCRW. Together with Sarah Fay, who produces this show, I'm going to be launching an independent newsletter and audio project that I'm very excited about, and I hope you will be too. I'll be able to tell you more about that in the coming weeks. Left, Right, and Center has a 25-year history at KCRW. It's been an honor to host this show for nearly seven of those years, a very turbulent and interesting time in American politics. Civilized yet provocative conversation remains as essential as ever, as essential as it was when this show launched with Arianna Huffington and Matt Miller and Bob Scheer, and the show will continue into the new year with new hosts here at KCRW. We'll also have news for you on that in the coming weeks. But for the next 6 weeks, I will be here, still hosting this show, still bringing you those civilized yet provocative conversations, and I'm very excited to have that remaining time with you here at KCRW. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Elizabeth Brunig, Tim Carney, and Oli Wine. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our production fellow is Nisha Venkat. The show is recorded and mixed by Desmond Taylor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more of Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.